Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The decades-long drug war in Latin America and the Caribbean has claimed countless lives. Drug trafficking networks have amassed tens of billions of dollars, transforming gangs into cartels wielding immense violence and power. In his new book, Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America, today's guest, Yoan Grillo, writes, south of the border, the cartels spent their billions building armies of assassins who carry out massacres comparable to those in war zones, and they outgun police. They have diversified from drugs to a portfolio of crimes, including kidnapping, theft of crude oil, and even wildcat mining. And they've grown to control the government of entire cities and states in Latin America. From the gas in your car, to the gold in your jewelry, to the tens of thousands of Americans calling for refugee status in the U.S., it's no longer an issue we can continue to ignore. In the book, Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America, Yoan Grillo writes about what he calls the new battlefields of the Americas. He says this war has spiraled out of control and needs to be dealt with now. Yoan Grillo has covered Latin America since 2001 and gained access up the cartel chain. He reported for a number of outlets, including Reuters and CNN. His first book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, was translated into 5 languages. Yoan is a native of England, and he lives in Mexico City. He'll be speaking tonight in Berkeley at the First Congregational Church at 7:30, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And this morning, he joins me here in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Great to be here.
It's great to have you. So you have covered this issue in depth since 2001. You've gained access up the cartel chain. Why did you decide to cover this particular issue? What about it interests you?
Well, I first came to Latin America with the idea of covering, you know, politics and change. You know, I'd seen the Latin America of the 20th century, the end of the 20th century, and the idea of left-wing guerrillas and socialist movements and these kind of things, military dictatorships. But when I arrived, that had all changed. Most of the guerrilla groups had disbanded. Many of the former members had become politicians, even presidents. Most of the military dictatorships had stopped. But we had this new issue, which was in the background and growing bigger and bigger, that of drug cartels. And living in Mexico, I saw the strength of these cartels grow and grow. And I realized this is the real issue of the day. The fights, the wars, the battles are not between the left and the right in many places. It's concerning these cartels and governments fighting them, and very gray areas, very unclear who's the good and the bad in this conflict.
Hmm. What is it like to report from this area and gain access? El Chapo is receiving international headlines because of the Sean Penn interview, and a lot of Mexican journalists said, excuse me, we've been doing this story for decades. We're being killed because we're trying to get this story out. So what is it like for you as a white man to cover Latin America and the drug war?
When you're talking to people involved in cartels at different levels, whether it be in Mexico or the gangs in Central America or people in Brazil, being from completely outside the area has some advantages in that you're not seen as a direct threat. Sometimes if people, for example, in these areas that gangs control, if they see somebody come into the area, their immediate reaction is this person a rival or is he working for the police? And so that's the first question on many people's minds. When you talk to people who are assassins, who are killers, who are mass murderers, although they have done many evil things, you can also find their human sides. You can talk to them, and it's quite striking how some of these people, although they've often killed more people they can count, are not. You don't find them immediately psychotic. They seem to be people who are who can talk, be friendly, and tell their stories. And it's difficult sometimes, you know, what is the ethical question here? How much should we give them exposure? And I think it is important to talk to them and to hear their stories, but we have to be very careful about how we cover that as well, and to show the pain they cause, to show the pain this is causing to many nations across Latin America.
Let's talk about how you begin your book. You are in a bookshop cafe, and you're waiting for a man named Robert. He is a white New Yorker with a university education. You write that Latin American journalists complain the U.S. side of the equation is never examined. Who are the partners of the cartels wreaking havoc south of the Rio Grande, they ask? Where is the American narco? And here you found one.
Yeah, it's a very common complaint, people say, and it's a valid complaint. People make it from Mexico. In the news, we often hear about the big drug traffickers in Mexico, from Mexico. What about the drug traffickers in the United States?
Right.
Now, in the United States is the biggest drug consumer on the planet. The White House estimates that Americans spend $100 billion every year on cocaine, crystal meth, marijuana, and heroin. Now, obviously, people are moving those drugs all around the United States. You can find drugs in any city in the United States. I went to Phoenix, Arizona for a documentary. I was looking at crystal meth, and it took me about 15 minutes to find somebody selling crystal meth. I was simply arrived in the square people were hanging out, asked people, you know, anyone selling drugs, about 15 minutes to find people selling crystal meth. So you can see these drugs are all over the United States. Yeah. That they're moving, they're coming in from Mexico. Now, this particular case was somebody, it was a curious series of events. Another British guy was actually traveling across southern United States, went into Mexico, was held by some guys, and they demanded a ransom payment for him. But he actually created a friendship with one of the people who knew them, who was this American trafficker who'd spent 40 years taking drugs, bringing drugs from Mexican traffickers to all corners of the United States, including here in Berkeley. He bought packages of marijuana up here, as well as Mississippi, Alabama, and all kinds of places.
And so tell us more about Robert, because he says something that I think this is one of the key quotes in your book. He says, back in the old days, it was nothing like this. They were just drug smugglers. Now they prey on their communities. They have become too powerful. Many of the young guys working for them are crazy killers who are high on meth. You can't deal with these people. And then he says, it's just business. They should have legalized many of these drugs a long time ago.
Well, and a lot of drug traffickers have interesting ways of seeing this, and they can be quite contradictory in a way. But it's often you hear people who traffic drugs will say this as a way to justify it. Will say, well, look, these drugs should be legal anyway. I'm just providing a service. People want to buy drugs. I'm taking drugs over the border. Now, they're justifying themselves making a lot of money. But they have a certain point there. I mean, this market is there. The demand for drugs is there. The thing about the drug economy is it creates insane amounts of money. It creates this incredible value. You buy a kilo of cocaine for $2,000 in Colombia, and you sell it on the U.S. border for $30,000. When it reaches New York, it sells for more than $100,000. Now, anybody who would have that kind of markup in money, imagine any kind of business. You know, people struggle with businesses where they're making a markup of 5%. You know, just about making enough money, buying something for $100 and selling it for $110, $105. Imagine that you can invest $200, you know, get yourself back $3,000. And that is why people keep getting involved in this, making crazy amounts of money, and the most violent people win and control that business.
How difficult is it to follow the money? I mean, from Mexico to, say, some of these rural parts of the United States where people are taking heroin now. You look at the headlines, the United States is dealing with a heroin epidemic.
Yeah, following the money is another question. You know, you try and follow the dollars moving around with this. And I talked to one lawyer who'd been the lawyer of Pablo Escobar, as well as many drug traffickers in Colombia. And he said to me, nowadays, many of his clients, they used to move a lot of money in Panama. Nowadays, many of his clients are moving money into China. So, you know, these days where you have a globalized economy with transactions, money zapping around all around the planet, you know, this money being made can suddenly be in, you know, all kinds of places. But as well as that, you know, drug cartels have sophisticated ways of laundering money in Mexico, buying hotels, buying houses. And there's cases of people. There's a case of one guy who provided the precursors for crystal meth, who was flying up to Las Vegas with big suitcase of money and spending that and getting checks back. So you can see, you know, casinos, all kinds of places that money is being laundered.
Talk about the rise of drug trafficking from small-time gangs that transformed into these massive, powerful cartels. You write that from Mexico to Brazil, Jamaica, these militias have killed so many people. The fact that these crime militias have cropped up simultaneously in different countries is no coincidence, but shows a regional trend, a product of historical circumstances. And while these conflicts are in separate countries, drugs, guns, and gangsters float between them. It's a chain of crime wars slicing through the continent.
Sure. So covering this in Mexico, and I saw a clear change while I was covering Mexico. Originally, when I first began covering Mexico in 2001, 2002, the violence was happening, but it was a bit lower key. Still, some of the assassins then were guys with kind of shaved heads and tattoos and handguns. And suddenly we saw the groups change that, and they became paramilitary-style groups, heavily armed, former soldiers. And once the ante, everybody got more guns, got more paramilitary-style death squads. And we saw extraordinary things happen. There was a shootout with 500 gunmen against 2,000 federal police in Mexico. And then the crimes they commit also are unbelievable. We see things like the massacre of 72 people. Now, people talk about Al Capone, and still talk about the St. Valentine's Day massacre, and when he killed seven people, and this is 72 people in one massacre, and then covering things like a mass grave with 193 bodies. So covering this as a journalist, it became very complicated. What are we covering? Are we covering a crime story, or are we covering a war zone, or what are we covering? And trying to make sense of Mexico, I traveled around Latin America and the Caribbean. And you find the same situation in country after country. You go down to Honduras right now, El Salvador. You go to the favelas of Brazil. You go to the garrisons of Jamaica. And you find the same level of violence, these same crazy tactics. And, you know, you see historical circumstances that this move from the Cold War, after the Cold War, you didn't have the creation of powerful justice systems in this country. So there was big immunity. And at the same time, you had slums, many slums and shanty towns that people went to and made in the 1970s, and originally with some hope of finding something better. But the new generation are now born in these places and die in these places with little hope of really seeing something else. And at the same time, you had many former soldiers from the Cold War regimes or former guerrillas who had all these guns and were looking for new payrolls, and the cartels hired them as mercenaries. So all of these factors led to this new crime wars, this mix of crime and war that we now see across the continent.
I'm speaking with Yoan Grillo about his new book, Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. Yoan Grillo will be speaking tonight at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley at 7:30. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Between the dawn of the new millennium and 2010, more than a million people across Latin America and the Caribbean were murdered. Yoan says that Latin American politicians don't know how to deal with this. Washington has no coherent strategy, but this is no longer a problem that politicians can afford to ignore. So what are the solutions? If you have a question for Yoan Grillo about the drug war, if you are from the Caribbean or Latin America and have some stories to share, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Do you think that Americans understand how all of this works? Do you think we know how deep this issue is?
I think If you look at the American government, it's a many-headed beast, and there's very contradictory policies inside the American government, and it hasn't come up with any coherent strategy. And it needs to. We need to, as societies, confront this, because this is one of the big challenges of the 21st century. The idea of armed criminal groups overwhelming governments, overwhelming societies, is a big global challenge. It's not just outside the borders of the United States. You know, this means refugees arriving here, but also this could eventually spread to here as well. So I think the United States doesn't have a clear policy on that. It has different policies, like at the point, you know, policies on drugs, policies on guns, policies on foreign relations. But it hasn't said, like, look at the bigger picture and what is the real strategy here.
Right, and then bankrolling armies across Latin America from Mexico to Honduras to Colombia.
Yeah, so you see the situation where the cartels are very brutal, but tragically the security forces fighting them are often very brutal as well, and both are hurting civilians. And when we see cases where the soldiers are torturing and murdering innocent civilians. Now, the United States says, oh, we want to help out, and so we're going to give some money and support to these armies. But often you're giving money to very corrupt and very violent forces. So you see a situation where on one side, the United States is giving money and helping the Mexican army. On the other side, there's judges who are giving political asylum to people who are fleeing threats from Mexican soldiers. So that's a contradiction there. We've had other cases reporting on where local governments, mayors in Mexico, are being forced to pay percentages of their budgets to cartels. They're so powerful now, they have to pay a percentage of the town hall budget to the cartel. They're not only, the cartels aren't content now to simply bribe these people. They want them to pay the cartel. And so when you're funding money, the money could actually go to the cartel itself.
Well, and then what happens to politicians who say that they want to truly deal with these issues? I was just thinking about the mayor of Mexico, the mayor of a city south of Mexico's capital, was shot to death earlier this month. Mayor Gisela Mota, she was at her house in the city of
Temisco,
and she said that she wanted to take on this issue. She was shot a day after taking office.
Very brutal killing. I went down to Temisco and talked to her mother about this murder, and it was very, very sad. One of many sad cases. But this was the first female mayor of this town. She was 33 years old. She swore in on the 1st of January to this job. The following day in the morning, she was still in her pajamas in the family house. She lived with her parents. There was a newborn baby of a brother there, a new nephew. They were in the family house when seven guys came in. They kicked the door down. They came in heavily armed. They grabbed Gisela, and they beat her and murdered her in front of her family. So that kind of brutality and against somebody who's meant to be in power, now that really is a threat to power in these countries.
And what message does that send to others that want to take this on?
Yeah, well, I mean, the other mayors have said since then, they've received threats saying, unless you pay us, unless you work with us, the same thing will happen to you. So, you know, it's this act of terror, and there's the same acts also carried out against journalists, against many people, sometimes you get priests who stand up against this terror. There was an interesting priest in the state of Michoacán in Mexico, a guy known as Padre Gregorio, and he would speak against the cartel and give mass in a bulletproof jacket because there were so many threats against him. But he soldiered on and stood up to fight the cartel.
Let's go to a few callers or a call before we go to break. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. Some things are complicated and some things are simple. I take from what the guest has said that if drugs were legalized and the huge profits were taken out of it, and I speak of legalization in the target, which is the country, which is the United States, if they were legalized here, then there would not be the money, and then all of the problems of crime that he's describing, negative effects where people have to leave their country just to survive and emigrate to the United States, that all of those problems, or significantly, would go away. Is that the gist of what he's saying?
Thanks very much for the question. I do believe in drug policy reform, which means we have to change some of the fundamental approaches to how we deal with drugs. I definitely agree with legalization of some drugs, such as marijuana. I think there needs to be an expansion of marijuana legalization. And we need to have a discussion about cocaine now, because cocaine generates so much money. Maybe with the issue of heroin and crystal meth, we could leave those illegal if we eliminated from the black market marijuana and cocaine. But I understand it's not that simple. Even the idea of legalizing cocaine is complicated. Nowadays, there's a generally majority of people support legalizing marijuana, but not cocaine. So you have to really get this into the public domain. And how would you actually do that physically? That's a big question that needs to be asked. However, it's still not a magic bullet. Even I believe we have to try and take away these profits of drugs. We have to confront this issue. We don't want to see a million more murders for the next 10 years. But even when you have those, there's other things we need to do. You have to look at how you build a real justice system in Mexico, Honduras, in these countries, and how you give hope to many of the young people who join the cartels, because they join the cartels because they're offering more than the government or legitimate companies are offering them in life.
You also write that part of the problem is that so many governments are not coming to terms with what the problem really is. Mm. And that is that the cartels and the commandos challenge the nature of the state and its monopoly on waging war and administering justice.
It's a very uncomfortable truth, and governments do not want to admit this. This is bad for the images. People are very concerned about brand Mexico, brand Honduras, brand El Salvador, brand Brazil. They don't want to say, brand Colombia. That's another issue. Is brand Colombia? Colombia have managed to improve their image internationally, and a lot of when governments are confronting this, they're looking at this as more of how do we really improve our image, rather than how do you improve the reality on the ground. Now, the government of Enrique Peña Nieto, when he first came into power, they had a big idea saying we're going to change the narrative. It was a strategy. I mean, we're going to change the conversation. We want to improve Mexico's image. It worked initially, but then suddenly you get the disappearance of 43 students at the hands of corrupt police and cartel hitmen, and that all falls apart. Suddenly you get Chapo Guzman escaping from a top security prison, and that falls apart. So, you know, though you can work on the image, and that is a legitimate thing to do, you have to change the reality on the ground.
Well, and also talking about Pablo Escobar, for example, in Colombia, a notorious drug lord whose cartel at the height of his career in the 80s, early 90s, supplied 80% of the cocaine smuggled into the United States. And Narcos is a series on Netflix that's very, very popular. I was addicted to it. And what was amazing about that, and this is probably true in other countries, you can tell us after the break, but he provided for so many poor people who had absolutely no options. And I was reading the same thing about El Chapo.
Yeah, well, this is a common theme through many of these groups, and I look at around the continent. If you look in Brazil, for example, in the favela, often who has paid for the sewage system in the favelas? The drug traffickers. They put on free parties. They're very appealing to people. They put on free parties where they have sound systems and this funk music, and sometimes they have songs in favor of the drug traffickers. But they put on these parties and they win popularity. Now, sometimes for these drug traffickers, if you're making $1 billion, you can afford to give away $1 million to charity. So the fact they're making large amounts of money allows them to do that. And other ones are very predatory at the same communities. They're actually extorting and kidnapping people that they rule over in those territories.
Today, I am speaking with Yoan Griot about his new book, Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. Today, we are talking about how narcos are affecting civil society and politics across the Americas and the Caribbean. He says this is no longer a problem politicians can afford to ignore, but what are the solutions? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KLW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. It's toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at this show's website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable, and we will talk about coverage of Flint's water crisis. So many reports are focusing on 2014, when Flint's water became contaminated with lead after the city switched its supply source. But is that the whole story? And why did it take so long for the national media to cover this disaster? We will also be talking about the life-threatening Zika virus, which is affecting pregnant women across the Americas. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I am speaking with Yoan Grillo. He has been covering Latin America and the drug war since 2001, and his latest book is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. If you have any questions for Yoan about the drug war, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about the fact that so many drugs make it into the United States on a regular basis, $100 billion worth of drugs every year? You've probably been reading about the heroin crisis that we're currently facing. What questions do you have about that? And then also, what about the human cost of this drug war? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So what about that human cost, Yo? And because we read these horrible statistics, you write that we've got 1 million murders over a decade across Latin America and the Caribbean. But talk a little bit about the human cost and what's really missing in the coverage.
Sure. So when you get these statistics, they're shocking, but you know it's quite cold in a way seeing a number. That's 1 million different life stories, and you could talk about each of those life stories. Now, many of them are criminals, but many are not. And I've heard many, many tragic stories of people who have lost loved ones in this violence. Once you get a situation where you have heavily armed guys financed by drugs, trained to commit murder, you have very painful situations in the city. Just one of many stories. There was a mother in the city of Monterrey in Mexico when the Cetas cartel were moving around the city a lot. And these are very violent, predatory cartel. She was a school teacher in the city. She was in her home with her two children, her eldest son, who was a philosophy student, 18 years old, and her younger son, 15, in high school. And they were in the home about 1 a.m. in the morning. The door was suddenly kicked in, and 15 guys with guns storm into the house. And this, when you have heavily armed guys, they can just see they can take whatever they like. So they stormed the house, started stealing things, tied up the family. Then they said to the mother, "Which of the children is the eldest?" And she, you know, she didn't want to answer. She was just stunned. You know, how do you answer that? They're asking, you know, which of your sons is the eldest? And the eldest son raised his hand, called Roy, raised his hand. And they said, "You're coming with us." They took him away. And the next day, she received a phone call saying, "We'll have your son if you give us X amount of dollars, X amount of pesos, we're going to release him." She gathered money frantically, called family and friends, and gathered some money and took it to a point and gave it. And they never gave her son to her. The next day she was called and the number was dead. And she couldn't find him. Now, this disappearance, she didn't have any closure, her first eldest son. And her face, when I talked to her, her face was just a mask of pain. You know, that pain that I see in her face really says more than the idea of 1 million murders. This, that. And I actually met her outside a morgue when there's a massacre of 49 people who all were decapitated and had their hands and feet cut off. And she went there in desperation, wondering if her son could be among these victims. She didn't know what happened. One fear she had, and one fear many people have, is they take these young teenagers, young men, and force them to work for them. To you know, like child soldiers or whatever they're going to use them for. But she just simply didn't know. So there's a lot of pain caused by this this whole situation.
Did she ever find out what happened?
She's still looking. I mean, she's still looking. And there's many cases. I mean, there's thousands of cases of people going around. A whole movement of disappeared.
Mm.
Now, this idea of disappearance is very strong because back in the 20th century, back in the Cold War, you had these military dictatorships and they would disappear people, forced disappearances. But now it's these mysterious cartels doing it. And the terror that causes, because you never have closure, you never know. So even 20, 30 years later, and if you're a parent, you know, you're always thinking, is my kid still out there somewhere?
Have you been able to ask the cartels why this takes place? Why do they resort to so much violence? Have you been able to talk to them about this?
Sure. So often when I talk to these murderers, these what they call sicarios, the paid assassins, and I've talked to various ones and talked about their whole life stories and go through how they first joined the cartel, how they began to commit murder. And often their stories are similar. They're recruited into these cartels when they're 12 or 13 years old. They begin by standing on a street corner and being given a cell phone and told to call up anytime the police come past, or anytime any suspicious person comes past, they'll call up. There'll be lookouts. And then they move up the chain and they're given guns and start moving things, and then they're trained to kill. And they commit murders. And some describe when they first commit murders, they're nervous, or you know, a guy described how he first committed an assassination. And he went too close and all the blood and guts went over him and he had nightmares about this. Mm. But then gradually became used to this, became, you know, used to doing the job. Now, one thing that they take a certain responsibility away by saying that they obey orders. They consider themselves soldiers. But, I have talked to some people who seem to have genuine repentance about this. One guy I talked to in a prison in Ciudad Juarez, and he had converted to evangelical Christianity while in prison. Now, I was first quite dubious about this repentance about committing all these acts. But, you know, he said, he described that he decapitated people while they were still alive. And he described some of these things he'd done and said, you know, that he was without God then and had a process. And he said that he just felt very changed, that when he was doing these things, he didn't recognize himself. He was inside this, and it was like he was seeing himself from outside. But, you know, many people may ask if someone like that would ever deserve forgiveness. And, you know, this gets to some difficult questions. But I think one thing to make sense of this is whenever you have soldiers in combat zones, whenever you have people being given guns and ordered to control territory, commit terror, they will commit horrific acts and atrocities.
How do you think this affects journalists? Because you write that when you cover such slaughter, it's easy to become jaded. The murder stats, the confessions of killers, they lose their human meaning. As a journalist on this beat, we try to keep our cool covering a story of global importance, even while politicians try their best to ignore it. But sometimes we're too cut off.
Yeah, I think that's probably a goes for journalists in many spheres. When you're dealing with human suffering, it's tough. And I've also covered things like the earthquake in Haiti, when you see a lot of destruction. So you have to see as a journalist how, you know, you want to report a story and keep a cool head in these situations. At the same time, we have to have our humanity there. You know, we're not just covering, you know, numbers. These are real people with real stories. It's difficult often in the daily news to get that across. And I've written so many stories daily or done news reports. And it's hard to get that across. So when you write longer form in books, you can try and reach some of these deeper things. Rather than just saying, you know, when you report a story and say, you know, a woman and her baby were killed in this place, or, you know, a pregnant woman was murdered as part of these victims, you know, it often gets lost in the coverage.
Yoan Grillo is author of Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. He has covered Latin America and the drug war since 2001, and he'll be speaking tonight in Berkeley at the First Congregational Church at 7:30. Find more information at yourcallradio.org, and you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Peter in Mill Valley. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I'm enjoying the show, and I'm right by Berkeley. I'll certainly make the talk tonight. I appreciate it. But I have a comment. All of this drug cartel stuff makes for a good story, and I haven't watched all of the TV series or Netflix, whatever it is, about this cartel that's so popular in the populace, but we're not getting anywhere, I believe, in getting closer to a solution when we do not look at the economic context of this drug cartel. And I don't know very much about it, but I've been tracking the Middle East pretty carefully, and my take is that we don't have anything different than what we have in the form of an ISIS in the Middle East responding to a situation that is unattainable. I mean, it's absolutely, it can't be tolerated any longer. Everything is being ruined. We've got the same thing. It's called blowback. Mm. And I think we have the same thing happening in Latin America. And the context is not covered in the news media very well. Mm. It's, the problems are looked at, but the solution is only going to come when we realize that a third world depressed as much as it is economically is never going to work.
Mm. Thanks much.
I won't show up tonight. I thank you for the show.
Thanks much for your comments, Peter, and I look forward to seeing you tonight. I think a very good point, this, we have to look at the economics of this, and we can look at this in different ways. I mean, one thing is obviously the drug trade itself, and you know, we talk about $100 billion in the United States. Globally, the United Nations believe the illegal drugs black market is worth $300 billion. You know, and this is not... The drugs in Latin America are not just going to the United States. They're also going to England, where I'm originally a very big consumer of cocaine, Italy, Spain, many countries. Drugs originating in Latin America and going to these countries as well, passing through Brazil and so forth. So I think it's time, you know, really is, we're a historic moment right now. And it's time to get this discussion out in the open. 5-10 years ago, it was very closed. You know, people said, I always had this line that legalization is a non-starter. Now marijuana is being legalized, but we've got to broaden this discussion. And like I say, it's not that simple. It's not as simple as to say, press a button, it's all going to go away. It's a tough path to how we change drug policy, but we need to do that. But you also make a good point that these countries are very depressed and very poor in many cases. Now you have in Honduras, people are really struggling to make a living there. Many of these new generation of gang members from the Mara Salvatrucha that I interviewed, some of them are committed horrific crimes, but they're often growing up without their parents. Their parents are here in the United States. They're growing up without their mothers, who are here in the United States, often making money. Now, it's not easy. How do you make Honduras have a sustainable economy? That's not that simple. But you do have in some of these countries, like Brazil, like Mexico, you do have a lot of money moving around. I mean, Mexico has one of the richest people in the world, Carlos Slim, the telecoms magnate, also one of the big stakeholders in the New York Times. So you need to try and create mechanisms where money will go and help and transform the ghetto areas. Now, sometimes a little can go a long way. Just if there is some kind of effort to go to these areas, and you find on the ground excellent social workers from all these countries, from all these communities, who really have the skills to reach people. You know, and I've talked to people from Sierra Juarez to Kingston, Jamaica, to San Pedro Sula, Honduras, who know how to go into these areas and reach. They say, you know, I know what the problem is in my neighborhood. I know the 20 kids on the corner who are going to be recruited by the cartels. And you have to reach them young. Often when they get to 14, 15, these guys have committed murders or multiple murders. To a point, it's very hard then what you do with them. You have to find the kids before they start committing a lot of these acts and becoming combatants, child soldiers for these groups.
You know, I rarely hear anyone talk about this angle because we have a lot of farm workers in California. People working in restaurants are coming from Mexico. But you rarely hear people talk about what they leave back home and how some of these kids are growing up without a mom or a dad.
Yeah, well, you have a difficult situation now as well with the harder policy and the deportations. And you've had massive deportations in recent years. You often have, say, a mother who's here from Honduras. Now, Honduras is a country which has had massive immigration in recent years. And I was just in Texas, and you're seeing in Texas now, for example, many, many people in the school system arriving from Honduras and so forth. But you see, look, a mother who's here, and she has some steady income, and she's providing, sending money, which is providing food for her parents in some case and her child, and she's scared to even go back to visit because then she might not be able to get back into the United States. So you talk to people who haven't seen their mother for 5-6 years growing up, and then now they start getting very scared because they're realizing these kids are getting recruited into gangs. The gangs will recruit the kids, or the gangs could attack the kids. And if you're a young girl in these neighborhoods, it can be very hard. If you're a young woman in these neighborhoods and a gang member decides they like and want as a girlfriend, then, you know, you have had cases, you know, I saw a case where a girl refused to become the girlfriend of this gang leader in this neighborhood. And the gang killed her and they killed her aunt. I mean, this is the kind of brutality that some of these, you know, hard to fathom sometimes. So people are suddenly, they realize their kids are becoming teenagers and they want to get them into the United States. They realize, you know, they've got to run. So you get kids walking by themselves from Honduras through Mexico or going with coyotes to try and reach here. You know, we had 67,000 unaccompanied children detained on the southern border in 2014.
Well, right. And you hear that, you see these numbers, and then in the story, maybe they'll quote a few of the children or the mom saying, it's too dangerous back home. My child would have been forced to be in a gang and then maybe would have been killed. But there's not much context with the story.
Yeah, and it's tough. And it's tough with the logic of media when, you know, you're reporting quick stories and trying to simplify very complicated issues. You know, when you're trying to, you know, but this mass movement of people heading northwards is the biggest. Now, in some ways, that was a good wake-up call. I went down and reported the story for Time magazine in Honduras then after that. And at least then the media were interested momentarily. What's going on in these countries? How come people are fleeing these countries? And you know, you go and report in San Pedro Sula, Honduras, and you see that there's entire blocks that have been cleared out by the gangs. They've forced entire families to move out whole streets. And you know, you have to ask why they're doing that. And the reason is they control an area and they want to create defensive buffer zones to defend their territory. And to do that, they will clear out whole streets and say, you have to leave or we're going to kill you. So these kind of, you know, extraordinary things happening.
Yoan Grillo is author of Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. He's covered Latin America and the drug war since 2001. He currently lives in Mexico City, and he'll be speaking tonight at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley at 7:30. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. We have a few emails about poverty. Manny says, you keep talking about the main issue, and poverty breeds this. High-level government officials and big capitalistic industries are creating winners and losers, and no one wants to be suffering in desperately impoverished ways of life. Address the poverty and the high level of corruption, and these issues will dwindle. And then Bernard writes, Is lack of jobs the real problem here? Since the drug economy is international, the solution seems to be income for all. Maybe something like a UN program for international basic income as a right to livelihood.
Well, very, very good point. So, you know, I wholeheartedly agree that we have to look at the economic base here. And it is very true in the global economy, you've had these increasing distance often between the wealthy and the poor. You know, and we've seen the numbers come out that 62 people own as much as the poorest half of the world population. In these countries, we definitely see today in Latin America, we see quite extreme examples of this. And you have parts of Mexico, for example, which are, you do have a middle class and you have very modern, and sometimes these commentators go down and go, oh, well, look, this is great. President Obama actually addressed Mexico and he said, in Mexico, he said, you know, it's great, most of you are middle class now. Now, I don't agree that most Mexicans are middle class, most people in Mexico are middle class now. But this perception, because you see some development, but then you suddenly go out and see many people outside of that, outside of this. And, in you know, you go to areas where many people are recruited into cartels and the streets aren't paved. There's no water coming. The electricity isn't working. There's no local high school. So you have to change these areas. However, the solution to poverty is not simple. It's not a simple button we can press that will alleviate many people from poverty. We have to, you know, it's tough. What are the, and even governments or supposed left-wing governments in Latin America, like in El Salvador, for example, you had the former guerrillas of the Civil War era, the FMLN, rising to power there. They're, you know, supposedly against poverty, but they can't find a quick fix of lifting people out of poverty, and they haven't been able to stop the violence in El Salvador.
We have time for one or two more callers. Let's hear from Ami in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yes, I'm just calling to follow up on the response our guest gave to the killing of the woman in Monterey, for instance, rather the abduction of her son. Why is it that random people are targeted by the cartel? You explained that how they're raised in the culture of killing the murderers, and they follow orders. But why are the orders given to begin with to kill so many innocents? What is the end game there? Thank you.
Sure, yeah, thank you. It's a very good question. It can be hard sometimes to fathom the motivations for many of these murders, and you can see sometimes the mechanisms. We had a situation, for example, in the state of Tamaulipas, where a group of the Zetas were simply pulling people out of cars, stopping cars, pulling people out, and often murdering them and dumping their bodies. Now, the reason it seemed to be they were trying to create a defensive buffer zone of anybody coming from Michoacán State who could be affiliated for the rival cartel, and just simply saying if you had license plates from Michoacán State, they were going to just kill you in case. So often seems to be kind of a form of terror where they will, because they're trying to control a territory, and some of this is perversely influenced by members who are in the military, who were trained in forms of anti-insurgency and how they would control territory. And they have some even mercenaries who came from the civil wars in Guatemala. And in those days, when they controlled territory, it would often be with terror and terrorizing and killing civilians. They would decapitate villagers in front of it to say, like, if anybody stands against us, this is what will happen. Now, you see that as well in Mexico. You have these cartel guys, sometimes former soldiers, and they got the orders, you have to control this territory. And, you know, you see situations where they will cut the heads off alleged snitches. And, you know, there's the decapitated head with a message saying, see, hear, shut up, you know, telling people not to speak. But then sometimes you have, you know, very minor things. There was one tragic case of a medical student who was murdered, who happened to be the son of a Mexican poet called Javier Cecilia. And I talked to Javier Cecilia about this case. It was one case they managed to solve reasonably because he was a high-profile figure. And it seemed simply that him and his friends had walked into a bar that was owned by a drug trafficker and got into an argument with the valets of the bar over someone stealing a camera from the car. And this accelerated into a situation where the cartel people kidnapped and then killed the students. So sometimes it's kind of hard to fathom that level of murder.
Well, and just quickly, we have an email from Kevin who says, do they have a political agenda or is this all about money and power?
I mean, a great fundamental question that, you know, I've been asking myself and looking at. Often they will say they have a political agenda, and you get different groups. And some of the ones in Brazil, for example, particularly, they have this idea they fight for the poor. Now, in Brazil, the Red Commando was actually formed inside a prison back in the 70s when they locked up left-wing guerrillas with bank robbers and criminals, and they combined together. So they have this idea of, like, fighting for the poor. They say that. And you often see different versions of that around the continent saying, we're fighting for the poor, you know, we're actually achieving something, we represent the poor people here. At the same time, they can often be very predatory and hurt poor people and kill poor people. So you see, you know, often they will work with powerful people as a kind of paramilitary sometimes, if there's a powerful landowner who has some people he doesn't, you know, he can use the drug cartels and work with them to attack them. So that political agenda is very blurred, and the kind of having an ideology is very blurred, but you see signs of it.
And just quickly, does it matter when a leftist government is in power? Because that often gets attention here in the U.S. when we read news about South America.
I think we've seen from the experience of recent years that both the left and the right-wing governments have failed to deal with this. Now, we've had left-wing governments in Brazil under Lula, in El Salvador, in Venezuela, we all call Chavez, and there's been right-wing governments in, you know, Colombia, in Mexico with Calderon. And in both cases, people have struggled to deal with this issue. There's been attempts sometimes to uplift people out of poverty, but it's still, they haven't managed to fundamentally change this problem.
Are there any examples where they have?
Where they've achieved some things. You can find small examples here and there where things have been achieved. One example was in the city of Medellin. There was an interesting mayor there called Fajardo, he was like a mathematician, and he said, I see it as a mathematical problem. We have to create in the best buildings in the worst areas. So he built a music conservatory, and he built it in the worst slums. He built cable cars up to the slums. And violence did go down. Now, we also have seen some examples of police forces which have been more effective now in Nuevo León State, home to Monterrey, following all this kind of violence and disappearances. There was many rich people there, and they said, we have to do something. And they created a completely new police force, and one requisite was that people couldn't have been a police officer anywhere in Mexico, and it had some success.
Joan Grillo is author of Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. He'll be speaking tonight at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley at 7:30. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Joan, thank you for coming in.
Great to be here.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of Flint's water crisis. Most reports focus on 2014, when Flint's drinking water became contaminated with lead after the city switched its water supply source. But is that the whole story? Why did it take so long for the national media to cover this disaster? We'll also talk about the life-threatening Zika virus, which is affecting pregnant women across the Americas. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.